Good morning. States are told to comply with the Corps. How schools meet those requirements could be done through project-based learning. Education expert Bob Lenz is in Hawaii to talk about it. He'll join us later in the hour. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Global concentrations of carbon dioxide have reached 400 parts per million. What that milestone means for future climate work concerns UH professor Axel Timmerman. Today, he'll consider where we go from here.
And the French government bestows its highest honor on the Nisei veterans who did so much to liberate their country. Courage and honor on display at Maui's Nisei Veterans Memorial Center. And a young singer dives into the legacy of the great soul stars. We'll meet vocalist Kyle Allen McCarty with a preview of our weekend concert.
That's the conversation for Tuesday, May 12th. Coming up next, the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. Good morning, Beth Ann.
I guess I have to stop dancing now.
Good morning. I guess you do. Yes, it's time to get serious. No, there's been a new report on carbon levels. In spite of a lot of efforts to keep carbon down, they seem to be up, yeah?
And that is no dancing matter at all.
Exactly.
We're going to talk about that this morning. Now, a report last week from NOAA showed the amount of carbon dioxide reached 400 parts per million in March, the highest global average on record. Samples taken from the 40 areas were analyzed at the NOAA Center in Boulder, Colorado, and levels are expected to peak this month. So what does that new record level mean to climatologists and especially to the rest of us? UH Manoa Professor of Oceanography Axel Timmerman is a researcher at the UHM International Pacific Research Center, and he's back with some explanation. Good morning. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Now, you could look last week at sources across the globe, and veritably it was the same article from news service to news service to news service, all saying what had happened, but not giving a lot of real conversation to what this means. For example, when is the last time that we ever reached 400 parts per million?
Yeah, so 400 parts per million is a really interesting number, because when we think about it, last time it was reached was 4 to 5 million years ago. So that was in the so-called Pliocene, a relatively warm period where the Arctic was ice-free, sea levels were about at least 10 meters higher than nowadays, and the reason being that part of Greenland was gone and part of the West Antarctic ice sheet was gone. Camels and horses were running around in the Arctic. Gigantic mastodon elephants were roaming the wild plains of North America. So we had a very, very different planet back then. And it's not a perfect analog, of course, what happened back then, because there were small changes in ocean circulation that were quite different. But a large fraction of this very different planet that we saw 4 to 5 million years ago was due to the relatively high carbon dioxide levels. So we are essentially approaching a level that has been unprecedented for at least the last 4 to 5 million years. And that is dramatic.
And we're doing it quickly. I mean, this is not a matter of gradual change. It's a matter of very rapid change, because looking at even a 20-year or 30-year profile, those numbers have been slowly creeping up, or not so slowly creeping up.
So the pre-industrial levels are 280 parts per million. So mankind has increased the carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere by 120 parts per million. And currently, we are emitting 10 gigatons carbon per year. And I remember when I grew up, it was less than 5 gigatons per year. So we have doubled the rate of emissions, and there is no decline in sight. So that's a little bit worrying.
And you're not that old. I mean, we should say that you're talking about a time frame here of you're looking at about that 20 or 30-year period.
Yes, a little bit more, but yes. That's right. So this acceleration of carbon dioxide emissions is really worrying, and that's definitely something that, of course, the Paris meeting will also discuss. So what can be done to curb the emission rates? And another important point to keep in mind is if we really would like to restrict and constrain climate change to about 2 degrees Celsius warming above the pre-industrial average, So that's a threshold or benchmark that people are discussing right now to avoid dangerous climate change. We have another 500 gigatons to go. So even if the emissions were constant at 10 gigatons per year, we have only 50 years to go. But the emissions are increasing, so very likely we are going to hit this 500 gigaton reservoir that's left for us to hit this 2 Celsius threshold. So with increasing emissions, we are going to have perhaps 20 years to go on that. And the available, accessible fossil fuel reserves could give us another 1,000 gigatons. So,
I mean, that's a very frightening scenario. And of course, everyone's saying, well, what can be done about it? But before we get to the what can be done, it has to also move into the, do people really understand this? Is the scientific community effectively communicating what this is all about in ways that mean something? Because again, going back to the point of how that report was released last week, where veritably the press release just appeared from paper to paper to paper.
Yeah, I think there are two elements to this. I mean, when I give presentations, public talks, typically the audience is are people that experience a preaching to the choir situation. So I'm not converting anybody, and maybe that's the wrong word, but certainly those who are not really interested in that subject, neither want to change nor accept the science, they wouldn't go to these meetings. They're not reading really the climate scientific literature or the literature that's being communicated by journalists and so on. So that this is one element, but the climate science communication has many, many different elements. One of them is, of course, the climate scientists. They need to get engaged much more, I think, and particularly in the United States. But also the journalists have a very important role. And what I see very often is that journalists, on TV in particular, they like to have controversies. But in fact, in the scientific community, there is no controversy about the existence of climate change. So typically they invite so-called experts, people who have absolutely no credentials in climate research, that are calling themselves experts. And that inflation of the word expert, climate science expert, is something that has really hampered the communication of climate science in the U.S.
All that criticism taken just at face value. Looking at how we talk about this in a meaningful way, even a few years ago when, you know, it was 400 parts per million on Mauna Kea, there was still not exactly a passing nod to that, because we did talk about it, but it didn't seem to translate into a great deal of understanding of, and this leads to that, and then, and then, and then. Mm. Does it need to be broken down in much more, I don't want to say simplistic terms, but at least terms that people can understand in terms of their average and everyday lives?
Well,
how change would really impact them?
Communicating the relevance of what we are doing is something challenging, because we don't want to change our behavior. So we are a little bit the ostrich putting our head in the sand sometimes, because if we accept the science behind global warming and ocean acidification, of course, it would mean that we have to change, because already right now we are causing climate damage. We are causing costs not only to the United States, but worldwide. And the same, of course, for every CO2 emitting country. So they play a part in the global climate damage costs. And I think at this point, we have to make a decision. Okay, do we want to pay the climate damage costs in the long run? It can be very costly, in particular the sea level rise aspect of it, and ocean acidification too. Or are we investing right now, which would be costly? Yes, carbon tax, of course, is costly. But at this moment, we have the perfect constellation. We have very cheap oil prices, and we want to stay below 2 degrees Celsius to really avoid this dangerous climate change. So it's not like turning off the radio when you go out of your home. It's not that kind of decision. It's a much more important and radical decision that people have to make in their minds and in their behaviors. And I think that's something that's very difficult to implement in daily lives and so on. But it's on everybody's responsibility to contribute to really making this place, our planet, a better place for future generations to come. And it's about responsibility to children, to grandchildren's generations, and so on. And keeping in mind the CO2, the 400 ppm that we have in the atmosphere, even if we stopped emitting CO2 tomorrow, which is, of course, not the case, this CO2 would linger in the atmosphere for extra CO2 would linger in the atmosphere for another 1,000 years.
Axel Timmermann, thank you so much for coming in and giving this some context.
Thanks very much, Beth.
Axel Timmermann is a UH Manoa professor of oceanography, also a researcher at the UH Manoa International Pacific Research Center. The center's mission is to provide an international research environment dedicated to improving mankind's understanding of the nature and predictability of climate variability and changes in the Asia-Pacific sector. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:16. Coming up, preserving memories of Second World War heroism. But first, your backyard quiz.
Later in the show, we'll talk about a different educational model than you may be familiar with. So in today's backyard, we're going back to school on the Valley Isle. Opened in 1913, the old Maui High School was Maui's first and Hawaii's third public coeducational high school. Many graduates went on to do great things, but none outshined the most notable Maui High graduate from 1944, Patsy Takamoto Mink. She lived in an era when girls were expected to stay at home, take care of the kids, and cook, but challenged those stereotypes by taking class in physics, where she was one of only two female students. She grew up to serve 12 terms in the House of Representatives, and at Maui High School, she was active with the Student Council. For today's backyard quiz, can you tell us what position she held on the 1944 Student Council at Maui High School? Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know. The first right answer gets an HPR t-shirt.
Hi, I'm Corey Rosenlee from Campbell High School. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. Find out more about the show at hpr2.org.
You probably know of the heroism of the Nisei soldiers who signed up to fight for their country during the Second World War, the soldiers of the 100th Infantry Battalion and the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. What many people may not know is what those soldiers faced over there. The French government does, though, and in January of this year, 18 Maui World War II veterans were named Chevalier de la Légion d'Honneur, that country's highest honor. Maui's Nisei Veterans Memorial Center and Maui's Sons and Daughters of Nisei Veterans have created an exhibit to keep those heroes' stories alive, and we talked with Dave Fukuda, its co-chair.
About 2 years ago, I received an email from a friend I had met in France, and he showed me around the area of Epinal and Bruyere, and it told me that the French government was now opening their Legion of Honor Award, which is the highest award given by the French government.
Oh, yeah.
To veterans of World War II who served in France and helped liberate France from the Germans.
And this was in the very, very tough fighting that followed the Normandy landings, when we had a foothold in Europe but were encountering resistance every step of the way, yeah?
That's correct. In fact, the fighting they took part in was one of the toughest campaigns in the war. It was the Vosges campaign that started in Bruyères and went all the way to the Rhine River into Germany.
Very, very slow going all the way, right?
Very slow. We I show a map in the display there that shows their progress from October 15th through November 9th. And they traveled 6 miles in that time.
Wow.
And one quarter of all the losses that were incurred by the 100th and 442 during World War II on Maui, Maui veterans incurred during that period.
During that campaign.
That's correct.
And this is, you know, a lot of military careers come and go without a single firefight, and these were men who had a firefight almost every day. Yeah.
They were in a constant fight from October 15th through November 9th.
Yeah.
That's right.
Never out of danger, mortars, tanks, all kinds of opposition, right?
That's correct.
Do people remember, do people that you see, obviously, with an exhibit like this, do you find that people in Hawaii today, do they have a lot of knowledge of that legacy, just a cursory knowledge? How does that work out?
In most cases, I'm seeing a cursory knowledge. And part of it is due to the hesitation of the veterans to discuss anything about it heretofore.
Sure.
Even the among the sons and daughters, we find a very sketchy knowledge of this. That's growing, but this is part of why we're putting together these displays to bring awareness and pay, you know, homage to what had occurred during this time.
Sure. You do hear a lot of stories from Second World War, the families of Second World War veterans, where they say Dad was over for 4 or 5 years and he came back and never said a word about it, right?
That's correct.
That's obviously, if you're looking to preserve memories, that sort of works against you, but you can sort of understand the reticence, can't you?
I can, and That was why we jumped into this particular project, because the French government, in offering this particular award, required a 3-page application, which went into detail not only prior to the war, but after the war. They wanted information about the family and the individual, that, that veteran. And so I was able to use this as a conduit to go into their homes and talk to them about a whole life history, you know, which was very nice. And they opened up quite generously to me at that time.
That must have been an amazing experience for you.
It was a very humbling experience, but quite interesting and very proud.
Are a lot of your colleagues at the center, are they descendants of Second World War veterans?
Yes, they are, either by parents or uncles or some connection. But I think in the broader context, you'll see in Hawaii there's a large number of people that are connected in some way some veteran. There was wide participation during World War II.
You know, the loyalty shown by Hawaii's Nisei seems remarkable to a lot of observers, but it was really one of the most powerful characteristics of that whole generation, wasn't it?
Certainly, yeah. They had a lot to prove and wanted to prove it and did so.
Was part of that having a lot to prove? I mean, obviously, yeah, the motivation really was to go against the perception that they were greeted with, yeah?
That's correct. And we hear stories, and in some cases, you know, they were just brought on by the tide, like a lot of people during that time. But Others really, really felt the need to participate and show their allegiance to the United States.
And certainly show what they did. It does seem remarkable that so many years later that the French government came around to understanding that. But, of course, the French had a great deal to gain from the liberation of their country in those years.
Well, they did this in World War I, too. They opened it up years later to veterans who fought in World War I. And then on the 70th, as the 70th anniversary came close, they decided to do the same thing for World War II. They had offered bestowed this award on individuals prior to this, like Bonnie Hajiro from Maui, for instance, received his award in 2004, soon after he was awarded the Medal of Honor from the United States. Remember, there was an upgrade of 20 Hawaii veterans and 442 veterans that got their awards moved up from Silver Star and the Distinguished Service Cross to the Medal of Honor.
Dave Fukuda is the co-chair of Courage and Honor, Chevalier de la Légion d'Honneur, an exhibit at the Nisei Veterans Memorial Center in Wailuku, Maui. You can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Admission possible? Getting accepted at every Ivy League school and Stanford.
If you just work hard and you sort of live with integrity, right? I think that's what makes the difference at the end of the day.
Young Victor Agafe, a kid from immigrant Nigerian parents determined to make good. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Hawaii Public Radio thanks our family of contributors, volunteers, and community partners. Those would include Honolulu Chamber Music Series, Cakeworks, and AARP Hawaii for your participation and generous support of Challenge 2015.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bank of Hawaii, honored to be named one of America's best banks by Forbes for 6 consecutive years. Learn more at boh.com/bestbank, member FDIC.
Housing first. You've likely heard that term a lot over the past years as the state and city and county of Honolulu grapple with homelessness. But beyond the argument is a basic problem. There just isn't enough housing for Housing First. Silver Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, and unfortunately, nicely put, Beth Ann, and not enough housing for Housing First.
Well, you know, that seems to be the dirty little secret that we keep dancing around, talking about all the wonderful things that housing can do, and Housing First in particular. But if you really don't have the inventory, what does the rest of this all mean?
Right. And just a quick recap of what Housing First is. The idea is get the chronic homeless into a place where they have a roof over their head. And then you can deal with things like drugs or other types of addiction, getting them jobs. But first, get them off the streets and get them into a place that's safe. And sure enough, the city and the state have been spending a lot of money, about $4 million so far, in city and state funds over the last year or so. But the harsh reality is the numbers of homeless are going up. And we all saw that point in time report that just came out. It was from January, but it was just released. Think about this. The number of people that are homeless has jumped 35% since 2009. There's over 4,900 on Oahu. And then the number of chronic homeless, that's jumped more than 60%. There's about 780. Again, those are Oahu figures. But, I mean, the numbers are quite obvious there. The numbers of people that are homeless are going up. The number of units of available affordable housing are not meeting the demand.
And in part, you know, when people see the context of all of that, with a city, for example, like San Francisco that also had an issue with homelessness and how they've been able to mitigate that a little bit. But we still look a lot like San Francisco in some ways.
We do. And Louis Kinnea, our reporter, actually pointed that out. You know, the housing is very expensive. They are expensive cities to live, Honolulu and San Francisco. But San Francisco, which is larger than us, and of course it's next to Silicon Valley, but it has spent $450 million. That's a heck of a lot of money. But it actually seems to have had some success in putting homeless people into housing. So one of the things we may have to reckon with is whether taxpayers want to spend more of their money, or rather have government officials allocate more of their taxpayer dollars to help meet not only the homeless crisis, but just the affordable housing problem we have here. Remember that report that came out last year? Just affordable housing alone for low-income families, you're going to need about 10,000 units over the next 5 or 6 years, and we're nowhere near that.
And the bottom line question that, you know, is implicit in what you just said is, are we going to talk about it, or are we going to really build the units?
Right. As one official told us that works with homeless, he's saying, look, it's good that you're coming to grips, and by you, I mean government officials, but we really need to have a sense of emergency here, a sense of urgency about this, because the numbers are not going down. So, you know, 4 million here, 5 million there may not do it. Mayor Caldwell, for example, is asking 5.5 million for Housing First in the next year's fiscal budget. And with that, he hopes to house an additional 110 people or 100 people or so. But when you've got 4,900 people homeless on Oahu, you're just kind of chipping away. You're not really dealing with this on a massive level.
And that doesn't even account for the fact that maybe there are going to be more people who will become homeless. I mean, are you just offsetting, which means you sort of get a net zero gain there, or are you actually even chipping away at it? Again, going back to what you said, is there a sense of urgency about this or not?
I know this much. We'll be talking about homelessness again, Beth Ann, on this program.
Yeah, well, that much is true. You bet. Thanks, Chad. Talk to you tomorrow.
Okay.
Chad Blair reports on politics for CivilBeat.com.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the William S. Richardson School of Law, accepting applications for the Fall 2015 Part-Time Evening Program, now through July 7th. Information about the June LSAT can be found at lsac.org.
States across the country are coming to deal with the same problem, how to comply with federal Common Core standards. Strategies to do that is up to them. Education writer and co-founder of Envision Education, Bob Lenz, says it should be done through project-based learning, and his organization is doing it. Envision operates three high-performing schools in the Bay Area and trains other educators in its model. In Hawaii, he's worked with Kamaile Academy in Waianae and Malama Honua Charter School. He's back in Hawaii this week, and he joins us now. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
Excuse me. A lot of parents hear how much their kids need to know, and that's all based on content. But that's very different from the focus that you placed on the learning by doing, not just telling somebody or showing someone, but really having a student know how to do something because they are physically doing it. That's very different. How many schools across the nation are really understanding that difference when you talk about it?
We talk about it as a balance of knowing. We still think it's really critical that you gain the core content and skills. But then the doing, as you mentioned, through project-based learning and performance assessment so that students can demonstrate and apply what they know. And then thirdly, they can reflect so they can really learn to learn we see a growing movement across the country. Our Envision Learning Partners now is working in 9 different states, serving almost 10,000 students across the country. And through a partnership with other networks, 100,000 students this year are doing curriculum-embedded projects that are based on the Envision model.
Has it become easier for schools to deal with how they meet the Common Core standards than it has been, for example, to meet No Child Left Behind?
Exactly. I think when people look at the Common Core standards, and that it's asking kids not only to know facts, but to think critically, to be an effective communicator, they immediately see that project-based learning is the how on how you get to the standards. We think it's also the why, because it engages kids and prepares them for their future.
You and some of your colleagues have a new book out called Transforming Schools, Using Project-Based Learning, Performance Assessment, and Common Core Standards. In it, pretty much in the middle of the book, you say the Common Core puts the wind at our back for the first time in a long time. They aren't perfect, but these standards go a long way toward closing the gap between what we have to do and what we should be doing. Many of the state standards have emphasized what students should know over what they should be able to do. The Common Core flips the center of gravity to the other side, from knowing to doing. How exactly is that happening in a way that hasn't been able to happen before? Because, I mean, some of these ideas are not new ones, Bob, and you know that. There mm-hmm. are schools like, you know, Waldorf and others that have been using that hands-on model for a very long time. And sometimes timing is everything. Is now the right time for this?
It's the time is now. We're really excited. And the wind at your back and the wind at your face was purposeful, because when we launched Envision Schools in 2003, about the same exact time that No Child Left Behind started our movement towards a standardized test as a measure of just knowing. And we felt for a long time the wind was in our face. And now with the Common Core standards, we feel like there's momentum building, that we're actually have the opportunity for policy to drive the type of practice that we think is best for kids. Literally, our teachers and principals, when they read the Common Core standards for the first time, broke out in applause. They felt like the work that they were doing, that they knew was good for kids, now was actually more in alignment with what the country said and the state of California said they were going to commit to.
Which clearly was not the case when No Child Left Behind came out, and people were wondering, how can we possibly do this with no funding to be able to do it and just being told, go do this?
Yeah, I think the best thing that came out of No Child Left Behind was the emphasis on disaggregating your data to really know which students are achieving and which aren't. And often, as we know, it's underserved, low-income kids of color who are the ones who are not being served. But the answer isn't to prepare them for a standardized test. The answer is to engage them in their learning and give them the broad sense of skills that will allow them to be successful in college and life.
You're talking far more than just fill-in-the-bubble answers, but really understanding at a very deep level, which goes to that idea of deep learning. How do you really take that in and be able to think critically and be able to perform in a way that shows that you do?
Exactly. And that's what we know that students need in order to be successful when they go to college, when they go on to their career. We track our graduates. We know that our graduates are persisting well beyond in college what that would be predicted. Our first two graduating classes, almost 80% of them are either graduated or still in college after 4 years.
All of that said, there has been some pushback to this, and there are some myths. What are the biggest ones that you hear?
The biggest myths are that we don't have it's too hard for teachers to do project-based learning. We don't believe that. We know that this is the type of teaching and learning that teachers got into the profession to do. We do know that you have to build their capacity. And so we've seen all across in Oahu, not only are working with Kamaile Academy, but Kaiva Iona School in Nanakuli, the Sikhs Middle School here in Honolulu, Malama Hanua. And we're seeing veteran teachers, new teachers embrace this when they're given the training and really produce amazing results for kids.
How much training do they have to undergo to be able to sort of make that switch?
It's not only a matter of time, but it's sustained. So doing our typical work with a school will be a day or two in the summer. But the most important is the continued follow-up. So 3-4 visits of sustained professional development that teachers are focused on one thing, trying it out, bringing the student work, sharing it with their colleagues, and then going back and refining it. And after a year or two, we see teachers' practice change dramatically.
So give me a sample lesson.
Let me describe a project that we describe in the book. It's called the BP Oil Spill Project. It was for 11th and 12th graders. And they were asked the question, who's responsible for the BP oil spill? So in their science class, they did an inquiry-based science project where they worked to determine what would be the best dispersants for the oil in the Gulf, and then make their hypothesis and try it out, and then write a college-ready scientific report. In their government class, they put together a simulation of a congressional hearing where they actually ask the question, who's responsible? And they perform that for parents and community members in an evening. And in their research, they did a research paper in their English language arts class. We had policymakers come in from Washington to engage the kids, a few of the students in the work. And the policymakers from Washington were blown away by the amount that the students actually knew about not only the event, but the environmental science laws.
So you're also talking about integrated curriculum as well as authentic learning.
Exactly.
Wish we had more time. Really wish we had more time. Thank you so much for coming in.
Well, thank you so much.
Bob Lenz is the co-founder and chief innovation officer for Envision Education. He's a nationally recognized leader in high school redesign, deeper learning, project-based learning, 21st century skills education and performance assessment. He regularly blogs on Edutopia. He'll read from his new book, Transforming Schools, tomorrow at 4:30 at the Pacific Club. In the show, we asked you to name the Maui High School student council position held by the late Patsy Takimoto Mink. In 1944, she lived in an era where girls were expected to marry, have children, then stay home to take care of them. But Patsy Mink did her best to challenge the stereotypes. She took physics, where she was one of only two female students in class. She never strayed from a challenge, and that can-do attitude led to 12 terms in the House of Representatives. Her first hand at politics, though, came as president of the Maui High School Student Council, and nobody knew that answer today, so I guess we'll just keep our T-shirt until tomorrow. It's now 8:47. That's today's quiz. If you've got one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Good morning. I'm Kalei Stern from the Omidyar Fellows Program. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. All things and what they used to be lost. Oil wasted on the oceans and upon high seas.
Fish full of mercury. It's not hard to understand why young singers gravitate to the music of past generations. There are just so many inspiring examples. For Kyle Allen McCarty, role models were all around when he was growing up. And today, the 23-year-old Air Force senior airman is an old-school soul singer who's just back from a 19-nation tour with the Air Force's elite Tops in Blue show band. He's a featured vocalist in this Saturday's Sweet Soul Music concert, and he's with us this morning in our studio. Good morning, Carl.
Good morning, Chris. How you doing?
Pretty good. You know, when I first met you, I thought, you know, this guy's kind of an old soul in the sense that most of the music that you do was created before you were born, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, there's something about soul music, old school R&B and funk music that I just, it just resonates with me more than some of contemporary music today. It seemed like there was a lot more artistic qualities to it.
Well, there's certainly, there was such a wide range of examples, you know, in the heyday of soul, the 60s, you go all the way from the very gruff Otis Redding kind of singer to the sweet, smooth Smokey Robinson, Marvin Gaye.
So yes, indeed.
Pretty much anything you want is an example to learn from.
Oh, yeah. I think back then there was a lot more, in the examples you gave, a lot more men, especially like Teddy Pendergrass and those baritones that exist now. Nowadays it sounds like there's a lot of adults that sound like young boys, but...
No, you're right. That big voice singer, Jerry Butler, Teddy Pendergrass, guys like that.
Yeah,
we need more of those, don't we, Kyle?
Mm-hmm. There's a lack of baritones out there, huh?
Well, calling all baritones, right? What kind of exposure did you have to it as a kid? Was it around in your family?
I like to tell this story because my grandmother loves it so much. When I was a toddler, my parents had the same schedule working during the days, and my grandmother would babysit me a lot. And we're always playing old school music because, you know, it's one of the older generation of people.
Yeah.
And we always used to listen to this Best of Christmas Billboard 1955 CD. Uh-huh. Had the Drifters version of White Christmas on it.
Uh-huh.
And there was something about that R&B group sound, you know, just the harmonies and the bass lead, the high tenor lead. Just something about that particular sound resonated with me so much. So I really have my grandmother to thank for my love of soulful music.
Well, you know, especially, and this is on the East Coast, right? This
is
South Jersey.
So. I grew up in Berlin, New Jersey.
All right.
Right outside of Camden.
But that whole idea of street corner harmony in the cities, in New York and Philly especially, where, you know, guys would gather around on the street corner, find a good echo, and fit all those parts together. That was, you're sort of a part of that legacy came down your way, right?
Yeah, you know, when I was in high school, I had a few singing groups with my friends Brandon and Chris and Deontay, and we used to find like the best the best bathroom in high school because it had that reverb.
Right. Yeah, nothing like tile walls. You even hear stories of recording studios where they send the singer into the bathroom with a microphone, get that echo. Well, one of the songs we're going to do on this weekend's concert is an Al Green standard. So let's knock that one out while we're
sure thing.
Out.
Love and happiness, yes, something that can make you do wrong, make you do right, yeah. Love and happiness. Something's going wrong. Someone's on the phone. 3 o'clock in the morning. Well, talking about how she can make it right. Yeah. Well, happiness is when you really feel good about somebody. And nothing wrong with being in love with someone. Oh, baby, oh, baby. Oh, ow. Love and happiness. Well, love and happiness. You better be good to me. I'll be good to you. We'll be together. well, see each other walk away with victory. Oh, baby, oh, baby, oh, oh. Come on, love and happiness. Well, love and happiness. Love and happiness. Love and happiness.
Yeah. All right, Kyle, that was fun.
Yeah, man.
So was that what you just did? 19 countries.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about Tops in Blue.
Tops in Blue is the Air Force's elite, as you said, entertainment unit, and it's expeditionary. By that, we had a two-month rehearsal in San Antonio, Texas, which is the home of Tops in Blue, over at Lackland Air Force Base. And after the rehearsals, we immediately started to do this really elaborate tour where we're our own roadies. Tops in Blue travels with 64,000 pounds of stage equipment.
Wow.
And the performers, the singers and musicians and the technicians, they set up all of that before and tear it down after each show.
They work here.
Yes. And we went all over Asia, all over the continental U.S., and in Europe, and finished the tour during the Christmas season in the Middle East to perform for the deployed troops who are missing their family and a taste of home.
Sure.
During the Christmas season.
Sure. And very precise show, right?
We rehearsed hours and hours. Some of our longest rehearsal days was like 20, 22 hours of just, because our choreography had to be like that, had to be precise. The harmonies had to be like that. And you have to have, the vocalists particularly have to, do all that dancing while singing correctly, which, sometimes it's hard to do.
Oh, yeah, frequently it's hard to do. Mm-hmm.
And the genre of music, the show itself covered many genres. Like, yeah. We went from contemporary pop to old school R&B, country, southern music. Different stuff like that. So.
Well, it's going to be fun this weekend, isn't it, Kyle?
Oh yeah, man! I'm looking really, really looking forward to it.
It's going to be great. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, thank you, Chris.
Kyle Allen McCarty is the featured vocalist, along with Melody Soul and Jin Brown, at this Saturday's Sweet Soul Music Concert in Hawaii Public Radio's Atherton Performing Arts Studio. And you can find out more about the show on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
I'm Ryan Ozawa.
And I'm Bert Lum.
Next time on Bite Marks Cafe, we'll learn how clean energy and crowdfunding are being used to cool classrooms.
Students from public and private high schools have come up with an innovative way to address a hot topic in education.
That's next time on Bite Marks Cafe, Wednesday at 5.
Chris, we talk a lot about educational issues, and as you were listening to Bob Lentz talking about project-based learning, was that worlds away from your high school experience?
Pretty much, yeah, although I got a very good education, but I got an education in very old-school, rote learning ways. It just happened to work because we didn't have any choice, but I would have loved to have done a lot more in the way that things are being taught now.
When he talked about integrating the same lesson through various channels and being able to do that, because that's what we're asked to do as human beings,
yeah.
Is to integrate so much information into some whole narrative that seems to make sense to us, or at least that we can, criticize a little bit more with more authority. But anyway, you turned out okay.
Well, just barely.
All right, that's going to do it for us for this Tuesday. But coming up tomorrow, now, what's the intersection of the cost of education and private sector's responsibility? Neil Milner has a look at one collaboration.
and domestic turmoil on Kauai within the relatively safe confines of the Kauai Community Players stage.
In the meantime, we'd like to hear from you. You already know about our talkback line. You may want to write down this number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If you like Facebook, we're there too. Just look for us at Hawaii Conversation. We tweet at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR if you want to get to me.
And if you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find them on the HPR2 archive. Links to more information about guests and topics are there too. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HPR2.org. I'm Chris Vanderkuhl.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll meet you in the morning right here for more of the Conversation. See you then.